This is the Norris Group's Real Estate Investor Radio Show, the award-winning show dedicated to thought leaders shaping the real estate industry and local experts revealing their insider tips to succeed in an ever-changing real estate market. Hosted by author, investor, and hard money lender, Bruce Norris.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and our special guest today is Paul Herrera. Paul is a government affairs director for the Inland Valley Association of Realtors. Paul serves as an advocate for realtors on local issues, helping to preserve and protect property rights and the value of homeownership. His unique experience includes an award-winning journalism career with newspapers in Florida and California, where he covered real estate, small business, the aviation business, and the confluence of government policy, politics, and business. And Paul, we welcome you to our show.
Thank you, Bruce.
There seems like there's a lot of stuff up for grabs in this year, and so let's talk about some of the key things, Prop 13 being one of them. A lot of people would like Prop 13 to be altered or done away with completely. What is the process for that to even occur?
Fortunately, the process goes through voters. So we don't feel that Prop 13 is under direct assault. It was passed by two-thirds of Californians. It's a constitutional amendment. It can only be done if voters agree to make the changes. That said, there are some tweaks that could be fairly damaging.
Okay. Now, the tweaks, do they have to go through the voting path?
Everything. Anything we want to do to Prop 13, even the smallest change, has to go through voters.
And it's not 51%. Is it?
No, it's 51%
of
voters.
Oh, it is 51%.
It is 51% of voters.
Okay.
Just a bare majority. But to get it even in front of voters, it does require a two-thirds vote of the state legislature,
okay,
both houses, or a pretty significant signature gathering effort, which we're actually the authors of one of those this year.
Okay. Do you see that anything affecting Prop 13 as a likelihood in the next year?
Anything truly negatively affecting Prop 13? Not this year.
Okay.
There was a challenge on split roll, treating commercial property differently than,
right,
than residential property. That was postponed to 2020 at the earliest.
Okay. Now, who decides that's postponed?
The people who have the money, who are trying to get the signatures to put on the ballot in the first place.
To overturn that, to where they can make it change whenever the prices change, basically? Is that the goal? Is to catch up like a lot of these apartments?
Or some version of that, where commercial property would float. You know, the tax bases would float based on some other triggering mechanism other than the change of ownership.
So there's two sides to that equation. The one side of the guy who owns a commercial building and is very happy where it's at. But I guess the view is that's costing a lot of revenue. So if the bill were to pass, what do you think the net effect would be to prices of that type of inventory and the willingness to even own it?
Well, anytime you raise taxes on something, you reduce its attractiveness.
Yes.
So you reduce attractiveness, you reduce its value. Now, there's other factors. The strength of the economy, who knows what else is happening at that period of time, but it has some dampening effect. And the question we ask a lot is that California has adapted to being a state where property taxes are relatively low.
Yes.
As tax rates go, we're a low tax state when it comes to property taxes. We've adapted by making income taxes very, very high.
Yes.
So the question we often ask is, okay, you say you need more revenue, or this is costing revenue. You want to raise taxes here, or raise it in this manner or that manner. How much? How much do you need? What are we trying to get to? And what problems are we trying to solve by collecting X percentage of our economy in taxation? Because we have adapted. Does that mean that if we change how Prop 13 works, that we'll look at reducing income taxes, that we look at capital gains taxes, that we look at some other version of how our government works? Or are we trying to get to some figure that is, you know, multiples of our current state budget?
Yeah, and as a citizen in California, you do look at how expensive it is being here. And now, yep, especially in California with the new state federal laws for tax, you're not able to write that off against federal income tax.
Right. Well, it's capped, but yeah.
But it starts, yeah, but it's for anyone making significant money, it's actually pretty costly. And you start having the real issue of people migrating out for tax reasons. So
yeah, you don't actually have to make significant money. You just have to, if you have enough money to afford a home in California, you probably are hitting up against that $10,000 cap right now.
Sure. AB 2631. Now, you're probably much more familiar with that bill than I am, but that has to do with seniors. And when they sell a property, they're being able to keep their existing tax base?
AB 2631, that's the legislative version of the property tax portability item that we're working on?
Yeah.
So the assembly bill that's currently in the legislature is not likely to go very far, though there's a version that's now being discussed. We have now officially qualified for the ballot in November a voter initiative that would allow seniors 55 and older to carry their current Prop 13 protected tax basis to another primary residence. And that's without limitation on geography, so anywhere in the state. And they can also buy a more expensive property with a blended basis in which you take the portion that's protected and then add in whatever you buy up from. And you could do it multiple times, unlimited number of times in your lifetime.
Okay.
So now once you become a senior, you have a built-in tax basis for as long as you own property. And that is on schedule to be on the November ballot.
Okay. I like that idea, except for I've got a pretty big tax bill anyway. So, but
I'm just curious, why unlimited? If the thought is just sort of like a one, if they're looking to downsize, and what was the thought behind the unlimited piece?
Well, currently we have Prop 90 and Prop 60, both of which give a one-time exemption. Prop 60, every county in California. Prop 90, I think 9 out of the 61 counties has Prop 90, allowing someone to come in from a different county. It's that one-time use can become a barrier. Frankly, once you turn 55, you might have another generation of lifetime left to go.
Sure, that's right. 55 is not, it isn't like people are old at 55 at this point. That's right. You could still have kids at home or something, too, because you don't have kids until later.
Right. There's other impacts. Also, under the current law, if you're married, the limitations to one for both sides of the equation. So if they divorce later on, or someone could be 55 and their spouse could be 45, they both lose it. It's gone. We make it unlimited. Now, the fact that it's unlimited doesn't mean it's necessarily going to be useful to use it every 5 years. You just don't necessarily have that much of a basis to step up, depending on what happens with property values. We did want it to be universal. I worked on the group that developed it over the last couple of years. It was about 8 of us. And our initial concept was to make it for everybody, regardless of age. We wanted people to be able to be incentivized to purchase property, purchase a home early. And now you have purchased a level of affordability, not just on your home, but also on your tax basis.
Yeah, so it'd be a fixed number.
Right. Okay. So you purchase a home if you're fortunate enough to do so at age 25. And a decade later, you now want to move into a larger home because you care about school districts and you have a family. And we wanted you to not face a steeply increased tax bill. Now, that didn't poll as well. There were some concerns about that and the cost that would bring.
How do both sides fund their efforts to, get something passed or prevent something to get passed? The realtors obviously have an association of realtors that is part of what they contribute every year go to the causes that they want to get back. Is that how it works?
Yes. With the realtors, the members provide voluntary funds as well as dues, their membership fees each year, both of which, a portion of which, go into whether it's voluntary that they pay above and beyond their dues, or whether it's a portion of what they pay as membership. That's what funds our political action. And by political action, people think of candidates. The vast majority of the money actually goes to issues.
Okay.
I'm just curious, does the California Association of Realtors accept donations outside of membership?
They do to an extent. There's certain limitations on exactly how that works. And what's more likely is that the association will join coalition efforts where multiple groups are putting in funds into the same into the same issue. And this has to do more with states, ballot initiatives, for instance.
Okay.
Or perhaps a candidate issue. If you're talking about lobbying efforts in Sacramento, where we're talking to lawmakers and trying to sway votes in one direction or another, then that's mostly paying our staff and representatives to be up there talking to senators and assembly members and explain to their staffs, this is how this works, this is the impact they may have, this is why we're concerned about, or this is why we think it's a good idea. And that can be a coalition effort as well, where it's not just us, but there could be all kinds of groups that we're working with.
Well, then this week and next week, we're going to be talking a lot of issues that specifically impact real estate investors, and we don't necessarily have a lobbying wing either in the state or nationally. So it's, where do you plug in if you want to get involved and you're not a member of CAR? Just trying to give people options.
Oh, gotcha. It's a real issue. There isn't a particularly cohesive organization that represents investors, to some extent landlords. We've noticed that. And it makes it challenging to deal with what a real challenge is happening right now to those industries. We're seeing some of the strongest obstacles that are being proposed legislatively and through the ballot. And finding the right partners from among the investor community, that's hard, because a lot of investors are, are lone rangers. They're
that's
out there.
That's exactly right.
They're working. They're trying to make a living, and they're not necessarily thinking about, how do I join forces with all my competition?
How is the other side funded? I mean, I don't know if there's the other side is maybe wears different hats many times, but for instance, if you're going to try and enact rent control, and we'll talk about that next, mm-hmm. but if you're going to try to fight rent control, who are you fighting, and how are they funded?
Well, there's always an interesting coalition of funding options. If you look at the current challenge to Costa Hawkins, which is the longstanding California law that limits rent control, that's largely being funded by the AIDS Healthcare, AIDS Foundation Los Angeles. That group gets involved in issues that are beyond what the name suggests. So that's where a lot of the money's come from in order to fund the signature gathering, as a for instance.
Okay.
But they also have organization, because there are tenants groups that are formed across the state in various cities, where you can imagine the amount of rental increases and the cost of housing has gone up so much over the last decade that there's a lot of angst over that. And so they have organized, and they're trying to find some solution to what they deem as an unaffordable situation.
When was Costa Hawkins originally implemented? Do you remember?
It was in the mid-late 90s.
Okay.
I can't recall exactly the date.
Yeah. So we had a big price run at that time too, from about 96 to 2000, we went up in price quite a bit. And I'm wondering if was that the rents and the prices just starting to make homes unaffordable? Is that what kicked it off? Or is Costa Hawkins really contain rent control? It's not, it really contains it.
It contains it. So
okay.
the primary benefit of Costa Hawkins is that it said that cities and counties could not enact rent control on new construction.
Were they doing so?
Yes.
I mean, oh, they were. Okay.
And they want to do so again, which
of
is
course.
Why they're looking to repeal Costa Hawkins.
I see.
And our argument has been, what we need to control price increases, rental increases, is supply. We need to build more housing. As long as there's a mismatch between our growing population, our growing economy, and the amount of housing available, then we're not going to see affordable housing unless you force it through essentially government controls.
Yep. When you have, okay, let's say I have a rental, and I guess maybe I'm more of a free market guy. If I have a rental and I just say, gosh, I think I'll get $2,500 for it.
Right.
It seems like the market will tell me, well, no, you're not.
Exactly.
Okay. And then I say, okay, well, I'm not going to get that. I lower it to $1,900 or whatever. And that's the market, and I'll have a renter.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I'm wondering how that gets out of balance, and if it gets too high, are we really concerned about people just saying, I can't afford to live here and I'm leaving? Is that going on?
We're seeing that, certainly. We're seeing a problem with really the California middle class being very much squeezed, especially from the coastal communities. And even Inland Empire, which has been a release valve for affordability for so long, things have gotten pretty expensive. And the way it gets out of balance is you constrict supply. You don't build enough homes. And so you have incomes that are chasing what's available out there. And at some point, they're going to bid it up until they find a place they can live in. Now, that's the way the market's supposed to work. And the secondary reaction is supposed to be that investors see that there's income to support more construction, and they build more. And that's where government gets in the way in the first place. So they start by getting in the way of new supply. And now in order to solve that problem, they're thinking, well, what if we constrain the price as well? And you just leave one problem to be solved by a second problem, which leads to all kinds of issues later on.
While simultaneously increasing prices for building and environmental, like, it's the weirdest mix and nobody's talking. It's frustrating to watch.
Yeah, rent control is really a strange concept. I know why they're trying to do it. And you have sympathy for people who are worried about being able to afford their rent and be able to afford their cost of living. But rent control is essentially government saying, hey, landlord and tenant, you guys are not allowed to come together and agree on a price. You know, we're going to tell you when you can agree. And you have a willing individual that wants to pay. You have a willing supplier that wants to give them a lease, and we're going to say no.
And just from being a tenant in New York City and places that were rent controlled, I can verify that the places that I did where that was the case is the landlords were not investing a lot of money because they knew they couldn't get it back out.
Right.
They couldn't hide that in the rents that I was paying, at least in where I was living in town.
Right.
But it was the kind of place where you plug more than one thing into a wall and the entire building would go out, which happened often.
Right.
And I was more than happy to do that in my early 20s. But it does concern me that they're not thinking that far in advance. And I can understand as a landlord, I don't know how you feel, Dad, but when tenants you're seeing in the Inland Empire even are spending way too much of their income to live, they'll never even get ahead either. But I'd rather see them have a conversation, how do we build more affordable housing? And I speak to affordable housing experts, and they're saying, yeah, there's problems. All the money's gone away. Nobody has the money to help us because we don't have the reconstruction. What was the funds that went away a few years ago?
Redevelopment
dollars are no longer there. So where's it coming from? Anyway.
I mean, the challenge is we can't subsidize our way out of a housing deficit, the size of which we have right now. And what we're looking to solve for isn't how do we get people who make $20,000 a year into a home. We're trying to figure out how to get people who make $80,000 a year into a home. That's the challenge. And the fact that we can't solve for that, we can't solve for $100,000 a year in San Diego and Orange County. Or the Bay Area, six-figure salaries. And it is difficult to afford a place to live. That's a challenge we can't solve.
You know, if a builder could profitably build what you're suggesting, they would build it like crazy because they could sell it all. John Burns just did a report on the cost of building a home in Florida versus here. It costs $800,000. For an $800,000 new construction in California, it's $350,000 in Florida. I mean, that's staggering.
Yeah.
And so, in other words, the lumber isn't more expensive in California and whatever else you're going to do, but it's all the path to maybe getting to the permit stage with CEQA and all that. And I guess I don't know what you could do with that, but a builder would be more than happy to build something that he could sell immediately, but the numbers don't work. So,
yeah. There's a great number, and I wish I had it in front of me, but I think CalMatters put together this graphic about land costs, building costs. And if you look at California, land costs are by far the most expensive in the country if you count all the entitlements into the process. The actual dirt, if you have a piece of unentitled dirt that's sitting there for rural purposes, for instance, someplace, it's not that valuable in California.
Correct.
If you have actually fully approved, ready to go, and permitted to build, it's incredibly valuable because the cost of getting to that point is out of sight.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we build new homes all the time, and what you can pay for the land, it's almost a residual number. You go backwards. Yeah. What did it cost to build? What does it cost to get the permit? School fees, da-da-da. And then finally, at the end of the day, you have a profit, and then you go, okay, well, that's what I can pay for the dirt. In the downturn, it was a negative number. You actually had land that was completely worthless or negative value. And now, yeah, it certainly has gone up. But a lot of the costs, we just built homes in Florida, and the cost of the permit and the speed of the process is just light year different. And I, you know, it's, you almost have to get both sides together and go, you know, we have to solve this, or we're going to have people leave. That's what it seems like.
There's an entire cottage industry in California of people essentially like me who do nothing but get paperwork through government offices, don't build anything, don't know how to, you know, repair a light socket, but just push paper in agencies in order to get the right paperwork and then sell the land afterwards. That's the fact that that industry exists, of people like myself who just know, you know, which individuals to call. That's a little hard to stomach.
On the other side of that, there was a woman one time that was watching our dogs, and she got her master's degree, and her first job was to drive out in the middle of nowhere where there was a potential building project being considered. And she was given binoculars. And all day she was there to look for some kind of endangered species so they could stop the building. That was her full-time job.
Worked for a lawyer?
I don't know what she...
guessing?
I don't know. She probably worked for somebody that had an interest on the other side. But right. I thought, that's pretty extreme, you know, when the other side is going to go to that extent. We only have a couple more minutes, but let's get just, if I own a building in LA that happens to be under rent control and you're my renter year after year, is it the same rent or is there a step up basis that I can do?
There's a step up basis. There's okay. a limit to what that basis is. And really under rent control, you have to, as a landlord, raise it to the maximum amount allowable each year. Otherwise, you really are making a mistake for yourself.
Okay. If I sell the building and the tenant stays, the rules still apply for wherever that rent is. Even if it's way below market, the new owner still has to adopt that low rental basis. Is
so
that
long
correct?
As they intend to remain in the business. If they intend to convert to condominiums and now make them ownership, that's different. That's called the Ellis Act. Essentially, the right to go out of business is what that is. And that's also being challenged right now. We've had to defend it 4 or 5 times in the last 5 years, just the right to go out of business.
In the Bay Area, that was popular to take down old buildings and build, you know, something that was so much more expensive.
Yeah.
And I think that was exactly what they did.
Yes.
If a building that's under rent control and I have a unit that's vacated, do I get to raise that to market rent? Or do I still have to stay with the basis that it's at?
It depends on local laws.
Yeah. And that, I mean, that's interesting because you have Costa Hawkins. Did I say that right?
Yeah.
Okay. But then you have overlays of every city has different policies too.
Yeah. Costa Hawkins essentially created guardrails and rent control. And what the opponents want is to remove those guardrails so that localities can do whatever they wish when it comes to rent control. And those are the concerns we have.
Yeah. Do you feel like that would, if that freedom was enacted, you'd really have cities all enacting some kind of rent control that would be more aggressive?
Not everywhere.
Okay.
In the Inland Empire, I think we're fortunate. We don't have this kind of mindset. And I'm not that worried. If Costa Hawkins went away tomorrow, I don't see rent control being enacted, frankly, anywhere in the Inland Empire in the very near future. Now, 10 years from now, I don't know.
Okay.
The Bay Area, that's different. Los Angeles, Santa Monica, San Diego area, parts of Orange County perhaps, that's different. And now you're going to have a lot more housing refugees looking for a place to live when no one's building things in their community and they still got to live someplace.
Hey, this is Aaron Norris. We would love to see you out and about town at different events all across California. If you are a member of the Southwest Riverside County Association of Realtors, you can catch me on June 7th at the SRCAR Realtor Expo. They always sell out, and it's going to be in Temecula. Hope to see you there. June 7th, that same day, if you are in the Ontario area, the Appraisal Institute is having their 21st annual Inland Empire Market Update, and we'll see you there. And then later later that same evening, we'll be doing Stay Put or Cash Out at the San Diego Investment Club. June 19th, the Northern San Diego Real Estate Investors Association is having their 14th annual anniversary dinner party. If you want to go and receive a discount, you better sign up soon. It's always a great night. Bruce and I will be on panel together being interviewed by Eric Saragusa with questions that they've sourced from their membership and their board. Always a really fun night. So check that out. Go to thenorrisgroup.com, hit the training tab to see all of our upcoming events.
For more information on hard money loans and upcoming events with the Norris Group, check out thenorrisgroup.com. For information on passive investing with trust deeds, visit tngtrustdeeds.com.